From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start the hour with the impeachment trial, which is back underway at this hour in the U.S. Senate. Today, tomorrow, and Friday, the House impeachment managers are making their case for the president's removal from office for obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. When they're done, the president's legal team will have 24 hours over 3 days to make their case. Franco Ordonez is NPR White House correspondent. He's in Washington with the latest. Hi, Franco.
Hello.
So the House managers have 3 days starting today to lay out their case. What is their argument?
Well, they're going to outline their case that President Trump abused his power and obstructed the congressional inquiry. We're likely to see more text messages, conversations from diplomats raising concerns about the administration pressuring Ukraine for President Trump's political gain. And Democrats are going to continue to push for more evidence. They really want to hear from aides like former National Security Advisor John Bolton and acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. And those are people who the White House blocked before.
Well, they lost in their efforts yesterday to get those witnesses and extra documents for this trial. Is it possible that that would change after the opening statements and after the question period for the senators, that some moderate Republicans might change their mind and say, OK, yes, now we do want witnesses?
Well, it is certainly possible that that would change. And that is certainly a big goal that the Democrats have, to try and convince some of these moderate Republicans to come to the table and support a subpoena to call for John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney to come forward. And we'll be keeping a very close eye on those moderate Republicans, such as Susan Collins and Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski.
The Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was asked today about whether Joe Biden or his son Hunter should testify. This is something Republicans have been asking for, and he didn't seem to rule that out. Which witnesses could be on the table if we do get to the point where there are witnesses in this trial?
You know, we've mentioned some with Bolton and Mick Mulvaney. Those you mentioned others. Those are still open questions. Interesting enough, just a few moments ago, Representative Schiff was speaking to reporters, and he was asked about the possibility of Hunter Biden coming to testify. And he was pretty blunt about it and saying that they're not going to make any trades for witnesses. He kind of compared such idea to a fantasy football game and said they're not going to play it.
What about the president's defense team, which is going to follow the House managers with their 3 days of laying out their case against removal from office? Do we have any sense of what their defense is going to be? We saw a little bit of it yesterday.
Yeah, we did see a little bit yesterday. And the White House has told me and other reporters that their plan is to fight on not only the process, but the substance of the House arguments. They say the president has committed no crime and that not only has he not obstructed Congress, but that he's been extremely transparent. They point out that President Trump released the rough transcript of the phone call with the Ukraine leader. And they specifically say that, you know, they argue that this is all about politics and that Democrats simply want to overturn the 2016 election and also interfere with the 2020 election.
President Trump has been in Davos, Switzerland today, and in a press conference this morning, he said he'd like to see witnesses.
I'd love to have Mike Pompeo testify. But again, that's a national security problem. But I'd love to have Mike Pompeo, but it's a national security problem. I'd love to have Rick Perry. Rick Perry has asked me, I'd love to testify. Please let me testify, because he knows this is all a hoax.
It sounds like he's trying to have it both ways there, saying he wants to hear from them, but that they can't testify because that would be a security problem.
Yeah. And, you know, the House Democrats tried to use, you know, his earlier words against him yesterday in making those arguments. He said that he wanted it before, if there was a fair Senate trial. Now there is a Senate trial, and he's saying he's going to leave it up to the senators. You know, President Trump has said these kind of things before. Our listeners will recall that he said he wanted to testify in the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, but obviously that did not happen. So these are things we have heard before. So until we see that, there's a good bit of skepticism to be taken.
Let's just finally listen to a little bit of what happened yesterday. This is Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, one of the House managers, who called for more information about the military aid that was withheld from Ukraine.
We need this information so we can ensure that this never happens again. Eventually, this will all come out. We will have answers to these questions. The question now is whether we'll have them in time, and who here will be on the right side of history.
And then later in the evening, White House counsel Pat Cipollone called out House members for investigating the president.
They've used their office, all the money that the taxpayers send to Washington to pay them, to conduct phony political investigations against the president, against his family, against anyone who knew him. They started impeaching him the minute he was elected.
Franco, just briefly, what do you think of what you've heard so far and how contentious some of this trial has already been?
It's been very contentious, and I think you can expect it's going to continue to be contentious. You know, we saw Chief Justice Roberts try to get control of that when he had actually admonished them and told them to remember where they are at and to provide the proper decorum. But that's going to be tough.
Franco Ordonez, NPR White House correspondent, listening and watching the Senate impeachment trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're keeping an eye on other news as well. The U.S. military is asking Congress for control over more government land in Nevada to expand its training capacity, and much of that land could come at the expense of the largest wildlife refuge in the contiguous United States. As Noah Glick from member station KUNR in Reno reports, the state of Nevada, environmentalists, and tribes are stepping up to condemn the plan.
The military has been using land in the Nevada desert since the 1940s. For everything from atomic bomb testing to fighter pilot training.
The activities that we do here, in some cases, are not really well understood by the public. There's good reason for that.
That's Colonel Chris Zolke with the U.S. Air Force. He's the commander of the Nevada Test and Training Range, the largest military training land in the world. At 2.9 million acres, it's roughly the size of Connecticut.
There is nowhere else in the world that exists with the capabilities that this range has.
And the range is constantly evolving to keep up with changing technology and military needs. For example, Zolke says some weapon systems now have wings which allow them to travel 10 times farther than they used to. And then there are advanced jets and GPS-based weapons that require more space to be able to test safely.
All of those things combined demonstrate how small even a space like this can be.
The current congressional agreement with the Department of Defense expires in November 2021, and the new proposal could add up to another 302,000 acres in the next contract. But this is where things get tricky. A big chunk of those acres are now part of the Desert National Wildlife Refuge, the largest wildlife refuge in the continental United States.
And all the way over to the right is what's known as Gas Peak.
That's Kevin Des Roberts.
And there is a trail there that folks do like to hike up because you get a good overview of Las Vegas to the south.
Des Roberts manages the refuge for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says he'd prefer that the current land agreement stay in place rather than giving the military control over more prime wildlife habitat.
It is the largest, last remaining intact habitat for desert bighorn sheep. So this is it for this species. This is the stronghold.
And Des Roberts says the animal serves as an important measuring stick.
You know, it's a large, charismatic species that really is a surrogate for hundreds of other species that also depend on this landscape for their survival.
Bighorn are also an important cultural species for indigenous communities here. Fawn Douglas is an artist and member of the Las Vegas Paiute tribe.
The bighorn sheep sacrificed itself to our people so that we can live and survive. And to respect the animal, we have songs, we have dances about it, and a covenant with it to protect its home and to stand up for it.
The tribe passed a resolution formally opposing military expansion into the refuge. Air Force officials did reach out to tribal communities in the region about the environmental impact of the expansion, but Douglas says they didn't work with elected tribal officials.
Our elected officials are the voice of the tribe, and it's really important to respect sovereignty in that government-to-government relationship. And what the local governments have done is strongly oppose the taking of that land at the refuge.
Tribal governments aren't the only ones who are protesting. The state of Nevada also passed a resolution urging Congress to oppose the expansion. Julia Ratty is a state senator and co-sponsor of that resolution. She says cutting off public access to the roughly 17% of the refuge just isn't acceptable.
The training mission is critically important, but I believe that if you look at the balancing test here, if you look at the critical habitat that we're talking about, we have to balance the needs of all of the public lands users and not always prioritize the military.
That said, Ratty realizes there isn't much the state can do.
The tools that the legislature has available to them are a resolution, and that is a way to show that this is what at least the state governing body believes, and to send that information back to Washington, D.C., and hope that they listen.
The Department of Interior is reviewing the Air Force's proposal and will present its recommendations to Congress before the current agreement expires in November 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick in Reno.
Here's some good news. Morning Edition from NPR News isn't just for morning people. Now you can hear every story from the start, weekdays 7 till 3. Listen on your schedule. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
We've been checking in with you on your New Year's resolutions to get more spiritual, to cut out sugar. We have those stories at herenow.org. Then there's the good old-fashioned cut back on calories. Let's stop there. If you are doing that to lose weight, what if that's not the way to lose weight? That's what economist writer Peter Wilson believes, and it was his premise in an article last year in The Economist's 1843 magazine called Death of the Calorie. He tells us the history, that the word calorie comes from the Latin calor for heat, that it was originally used to measure the efficiency of steam engines. Then, in the late 1800s, the thinking was food-deprived, impoverished people needed more fuel, so high caloric food was encouraged. But in 2016, a researcher discovered that back in 1967, sugar companies secretly funded Harvard studies blaming fat, not sugar, for obesity. So out went fats, in came sugar and salt-infused low-caloric diet foods, and up went obesity rates. We touch on some of that in our piece on the risks of sugar. But when we spoke to writer Peter Wilson last April, we asked him if he was surprised by what he found about calories.
I certainly didn't know until I spent a lot of time researching this story. It was a big shock for me, too.
It's just wonderful. You have Italian physicians in the 1800s hanging themselves in weighing chairs so they could weigh themselves, then everything that came into them and everything that came out of them. We'll talk more about this, but we want to right up front say, you are not concluding that what one eats is not related to weight gain or that overeating doesn't cause weight gain.
No, the problem is we are obsessed with the calorie. The health officials in America and elsewhere tell people that basically obesity is caused by a calorie imbalance. Count your calories, the calories in and the calories out in exercise, and you'll lose weight. You'll be okay. And it's just not true.
Right. Well, talk about some of the reasons why. I mean, start with the alarming misrepresentation of calories on packaging. You say processed frozen foods can miss the true caloric content by 70%.
The amazing thing is that these labels, either on a restaurant menu or on the side of a packet, are virtually never regulated. There are six different ways in America that a food manufacturer is permitted to calculate the calories in their product. And when researchers do tests, they find that in 7% of cases is the number on the packet within 10 calories of the real number. And in a fifth of cases, it's 100 calories out. That we're not making informed decisions.
Well, but you also rushed to point out a calorie is a real thing. I mean, you take us through the fascinating history of the study of it. Food was burned in labs to calculate the energy that's released. By the way, is that still how calories are determined? I mean, literally burned to see energy released?
Yes, that's the most accurate way. I spent some time while researching this story at King's College watching some food products that I bought here in London being burned in one of these, it's called a bomb calorimeter. And of course, the calorie readings on the packet were nowhere near accurate.
But even when a calorie is right, talk about some of the other reasons that we can't be too sort of addicted to calorie counting.
That is the thing that really stunned me, that not only are the numbers wrong, and not only are the databases wrong, but the whole idea that your weight loss is all about calories in minus calories out is just nonsense. The body is nothing like one of these little devices that I saw being used in a laboratory. that when food goes into a body, it's incredibly complex what happens. You know, the difference between sugar, the interaction of our genes, of our hormones like insulin, the bugs in our stomach.
Well, and for instance, the early researchers didn't care. You know, they just saw leafy greens, for instance, as something that didn't have a high caloric count, which people might have needed who didn't have a lot of food. So they'd recommend something, you know, fatty over spinach, for instance, back then, because they weren't thinking that way. And you mentioned genes. Just recently, a certain gene was found to be more often in fat people than skinny ones. You remind us some people have intestines that are 50% longer than others, and the shorter ones absorb fewer calories. It takes people from 8 to 80 hours for food to move through them. We're all different. And so, you know, calories are absorbed while they're sitting there waiting for 80 hours to, you know, come out the other end. And you know, sleep, for instance, is a factor.
Exactly. And if you haven't rested enough, you are likely to take on more calories from the exact same food that somebody else would eat. And with a good night's sleep, they won't create the same fat. Weight management, what we're talking about is fat creation. How well you chew your food has an impact. The time of day that you eat has an impact. There are just so many factors in our behavior that it just becomes silly to count calories and say, oh, well, because I've only eaten 2,500 calories today, that is fine. Or to say this chocolate muffin only has 200 calories, so it's going to be better for my weight control than this healthy sandwich because it's an extra 10 calories.
Can we talk about why that is? Because you, for instance, give the description of a soda, which sends a shot of energy, 30 calories a minute, takes it in quickly. And let's say potatoes or rice might take 2 calories a minute, you know, to process. But all calories trigger insulin, which help break down the food that we've eaten. So tell us why it matters if you eat something that's high in sugar or that's, you know, maybe takes longer to process.
The whole calorie system is based on the simple mathematical approach that energy in minus energy out, and that any calorie that goes into the body is the same as any other calorie. And that is just nonsense because all those different types of food have different effects within the body. The amount of sugar that is in a food will affect the insulin response. And this is, you know, probably one of the reasons that diabetes is exploding around the world because we ignore the sugar content. To have 100 calories of sugar versus 100 calories of protein is very different. Even 100 calories of fat is very different. So the insulin that a big hit of sugar triggers within the body to rush into the blood supply and try and get that glucose, that blood sugar, out of the blood has a huge impact. It starts stacking that sugar into fat cells. Once the blood sugar level drops, you're left hungry. So you've not only got fatter, you've got hungrier, and you're more likely to go out and, you know, have another chocolate bar.
Make sure I've heard you right. A sudden hit of sugar, let's say that soda or that muffin, prompts a rapid release of insulin, which carries the sugar out of the bloodstream into the body's cells. But when there's too much sugar and it can't get it out fast enough, maybe it'll store some in the liver, but it will most likely stash it as fat. So you get this quick reaction, but then on the other side, you get fat and you get a drop in energy because it's been so quick and it's gone.
Yes, and it leaves you hungry. So less fat, body fat, is created the more slowly the nutrients are absorbed by the body. So one of the first things I did while I was researching this story, I changed my own behavior and I just lost a stack of weight. I've lost 28 pounds while working on this story.
Wow. Well, because you found other things as well that were fascinating. The way you cook food makes a difference, and also the when you eat it. So, for instance, pasta cooked one day but eaten leftover the next day is half the caloric intake?
That's right. And the staggering thing, Robin, is we're only just learning a lot of this now. It's only in the last couple of years that researchers have discovered if you take pasta or toast and let it cool and then reheat it and eat it, you will take on fewer calories.
What?
Because, well, the molecular structure of the compounds changes and it forms different sort of crystal type shapes. And it will then pass through your body more. Your body will take in fewer of those calories. We don't do nearly enough research on food. which is just amazing. You know, when you think how important it is to our quality of life, to public finances, you think about the health system, the amount of money that's spent on food-related problems, and nobody is really out there doing this basic research.
Some of your other findings, exercise, of course, has tremendous health benefits, but unless you're really high level, it plays a smaller part in weight control than most people think. As much as 75% of the average person's daily energy expenditure doesn't come from exercise, but just moving around. And with that in mind, drinking ice water forces the body to burn calories to maintain its preferred temperature.
Drinking ice water is the only thing you can do that actually means negative calories.
Yeah.
Because there are no calories in water, but by putting that cold product into your body will burn energy to return to its preferred temperature.
It sounds like, Peter Wilson, that you have become, like one of the people you profile, a calorie dissident. We know that Weight Watchers shifted its own whole program away from calories to a point system with this in mind. But isn't there still some value to people knowing what the calories are in things on their menu, even if they're off a bit, just to be reminded of what they're eating?
You're right. I mean, it's not that we should totally ignore calories, but the problem is what we do with calories. We pretend and we tell people that it's all about calories. It's just one of many factors. And by overstating it, we lead people to make the wrong choice. We miss the point, and we make people feel guilty and ashamed, when what we should be teaching people is to focus on the quality of what they eat. Don't eat as much processed food. Eat natural food. It's just a totally different way of thinking about food. Eat the way we were supposed to eat originally.
That talk with Peter Wilson of The Economist first aired last April, and I already forgot to wait a day to eat cooked pasta. President Trump met with the Iraqi and Kurdish presidents in Davos, Switzerland today, his first meetings with these leaders since the U.S. drone strike that killed Iran's top military commander while he was in Baghdad January 3rd. That prompted the Iraqi parliament to call for expulsion of American troops from Iraq, and President Trump responded with threats of sanctions. Well, joining us now is NPR's Jane Arraf. She's in Baghdad. Jane, what did the president say today about the U.S.-Iraqi relations?
Well, both he and President Barham Saleh, the Iraqi president, talked about the enduring relationship because it's going through a bumpy patch right now. And President Trump was asked about the prospect of U.S. troops actually being asked to leave the country. And this is what he said about that.
Well, we're talking about a lot of different things, and you'll be hearing whatever we do. But they like what we're doing, and we like them, and we've had a very good relationship. And we're down to a very low number. We're down to 5,000, so we're down to a very low number, historically low, and we'll see what happens.
By that, it means troops in Iraq.
Yes, absolutely, and that's compared to like 150,000 during the U.S. invasion in 2003, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, but back on the ground where you are, how are Iraqis feeling about their government, about their government's relationship with the U.S.? We saw the protests at the U.S. embassy, but those were Iraqis protesting the killing of Iranian-backed militia members. There's other protests going on.
So those, the ones at the U.S. embassy, the ones that kind of trashed the front of the embassy, they set fire to the outer wall, those were members of Iran-backed militias for the most part. And that's partly what the Iraqi protesters are actually demonstrating about. So that attack on the embassy was followed by the U.S., of course, drone strike that killed the top Iranian commander here, along with a senior Iraqi official. And then there were the Iranian missile strikes against the U.S. base. So it has been a very rocky road so far.
And so what are you hearing from these protesters?
Well, basically, they've been out in the streets and they've been dying and being wounded. More than 500 dying, more than 20,000 wounded by security forces, who in some cases are shooting them in the head and the chest. Yeah. Security forces and those Iran-backed militias. What they want is a totally new political system, a government that's not corrupt, and they want an Iraq that isn't tied to Iran and isn't tied to other countries.
Well, and so what do you suspect happened in this meeting between President Trump and the, it sounds like, embattled Iraqi president?
Yeah, that would have been a very interesting meeting. Essentially, the issue is that there are lots of political parties here who do want U.S. forces to leave. The political system right now is dominated by those Iran-backed parties. And so when it came to a vote in parliament, it was those Iran-backed parties that held the vote. But not everyone wants them to leave, and it's an ongoing debate here.
And meanwhile, Iraqi's prime minister has resigned but is still in office, has not been replaced. How stable is this government? You hear these, you know, these huge numbers of protesters, they're being killed. Is there a chance that they might topple the government?
They got the prime minister to resign. He is, though, still caretaker prime minister, and they're looking for a new prime minister. They're looking for a new parliament. They're looking for a whole new political system, and that's a very tough ask.
Yeah. NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad. Jane, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Concerns are growing over an outbreak of the so-called Wuhan coronavirus in China, as Washington State announced the first person with the infection in the U.S. was found in that state. The virus has infected nearly 500 people, killed as many as 17. Helen Branswell has been covering this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Helen, we know that this virus comes from the family of viruses that caused the 2003 SARS outbreak, 8,000 sickened, 800 killed. So it can grow exponentially, and it's spreading to different places.
Right. So public health authorities are always really eager to stop animal viruses from spreading into people because, among other things, we wouldn't have immunity to a new virus. And so you could expect a lot of people to contract this if it started to spread globally. So, you know, a lot of sick people hitting hospitals at the same time, even if they don't die, is a terrible, terrible burden on a healthcare system. And that's something that everybody would want to avoid.
We're reading health experts in your accounts saying, you know, just over the weekend, there were 150 new cases. So when it jumps like that, what's the importance of health officials being convinced it's human to human transmission?
Well, so when a new virus emerges from animals and starts to infect people, typically you wouldn't expect it to be able to move readily from person to person in the way that flu or measles or typically what happens is you have this sort of sputtering kind of start where an animal will infect people. They might infect another person and then it dies out. When a virus gets a chance to adapt to people by spreading enough within people, it can go from one person who picks it up from an animal to a family member to a colleague at work to somebody sitting beside that colleague in a doctor's office. And that's when it really can take off. And if it's mostly animal to people, then there's a chance that they'd be able to figure out which animals are transmitting it to people and do something about that source to try to shut down the jumps. You know, as far as we know now, they have not found the animal source.
Right. And your thoughts on this man in Washington State? He came home after a trip to Wuhan on January 15th. He was in good condition. He seemed healthy. You know, people are being screened. Then on January 19th, he did seek some medical attention, and now he's isolated at Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington. It seems to imply that you can be walking around with this and still appear to be in good health until you're not.
Well, I mean, the thing that I take from his case is that, one, this virus can get around pretty quickly. I was expecting that there would be cases in the U.S. I didn't necessarily expect it would happen so quickly. And two, it sort of shows the potential weakness of any kind of attempt to screen passengers coming from Wuhan. You know, CDC has announced that it's taking these, what you might think of as fairly draconian measures to try to screen all passengers coming into the United States on direct flights. They're funneling all flights from Wuhan into five U.S. airports where they are going to be conducting temperature screening of everybody getting off the planes. The problem with something like that is that this man wasn't sick when he traveled. If they pointed, you know, one of those temperature guns at his head, he would have been fine. He got sick a day or two after getting off the plane. You know, when he called to make a medical appointment, he drew the possible link to what was happening there to the attention of the healthcare provider, so the system was ready for him.
You tell us that there have actually been other cases in other areas of, you know, people coming from Wuhan and coming down with this.
Sure. So in China itself, the virus has been spreading. There have been cases found in a bunch of different cities, including Beijing and Shanghai and Shenzhen in Guangdong province, which is not that far from Hong Kong. And Thailand has had cases, Japan, Macau, Taiwan, of course, the United States, and last night Hong Kong reported a case.
So, Helen, just briefly, you are not a doctor, but you are speaking to them. How do people know that maybe they've come in contact with someone, maybe not even knowing it, someone who's come from Wuhan, and maybe it is strictly human-to-human transmission, and they may have something? How do you know when to go get checked out?
You know, people who are traveling in China to China coming back should certainly monitor their health. This virus seems to cause pneumonia, and people who develop pneumonia will typically seek health care, I think, because you just feel really, really lousy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're likely to be seeking health care.
Yeah. Helen Branswell, with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication, keeping an eye on this. Helen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, it turns out coronavirus is already having an effect on travel. Shares of United, Delta, and American Airlines are attempting to regain ground today after falling more than 4% this week. Shares of some U.S. casinos that operate in China, including Wynn, also fell. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, here now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so how much damage could the coronavirus, or at least the worry and concern about it, do to the airline industry?
Well, I think, Jeremy, that's the key, the worry, the concern about what it could cause. When we look back over history, sometimes these health pandemics or feared health pandemics don't turn out to be as bad as feared. Of course, that's not to minimize the tragedy for the people who are impacted, but the financial damage to the airline industry can be greater than almost any other kind of event. You know, 9/11, of course, when it comes to terrorism, was in its own category. But after that, I mean, look at SARS back in 2003. That caused $6 billion in financial damage to Asian airlines, but $1 billion to North American airlines. That's not a huge figure in the context of an industry that does several hundred billion dollars a year in revenue, but it definitely moved the needle. So you can imagine if something actually turns out to be worse than it was feared, it could certainly cause a lot of harm.
Are there any precautions people should take if they are going to be traveling to or from Asia soon?
Yeah, you know, sometimes when you get on those flights to Asia in particular, you'll see people wearing masks even when there's no particular threat. And it can be tempting to think, well, hey, better than nothing, right? But it's important to recognize that masks do have different filtration levels. And if you're going to try to protect yourself against something specific, you want to talk to your doctor because you might be doing something that's not really beneficial and where it provides a false sense of security and in that sense could do more harm.
Seth, I want to ask you about something else. The Boeing 737 MAX, which we've talked a lot about, and they were expecting it was going to be back in the air last month, but now they're saying not until the middle of this year. And now some of the customers of the 737 MAX are calling on Boeing to drop the MAX name. What are you hearing?
Yeah, the co-chair of Air Lease Corp, his name is Steve Udvar-Hazy, not a household name, but as big of a rock star, you might say, in the industry as exists. A very influential person, this leasing company that places jets with airlines all around the world. He basically has said the name is toxic. Now, look, changing the name, of course, won't change the reality.
Right.
Boeing has bigger problems than that. But yeah, at this point, you know, is it possible that there are a lot of people that are just never going to want to get on something that's called the MAX?
Right.
Now, you know, I don't know that a new name would necessarily fool people, of course. That could be a start in terms of turning the page, although, you know, Necessary, maybe, but certainly not sufficient.
One more thing I want to ask you about on the issue of the 737 MAX. The New York Times reported on Monday that a predecessor to the 737 MAX, operated by Turkish Airlines, crashed near Amsterdam back in 2009. And apparently there were some uncomfortable parallels to the more recent crashes of the Ethiopian Airlines and the Indonesian crash. What's coming to light there?
Yeah, and back then, the world sort of just moved past it, attributed some of it to pilot error. But one key in the Times report is the idea that that crash way back in 2009 seemed to have been caused at least partly by the failure of a single sensor. And so this is something that, you know, with the MAX, for all of the various problems that might exist, you know, it's reasonable to think that it, even if a lot of the other underlying issues were still there, had the MCAS system been required to rely on the input of two sensors in agreement rather than just one sensor, who knows, maybe none of this would have happened. And so that one among several parallels to that issue kind of shows how it was the confluence of those two crashes mm-hmm. that brought this all to light, right, Jeremy? That first crash, the world barely noticed, as tragic as it was. That second crash brought it to light, and you wonder, you know, if that's really the reason why something systemic wasn't detected back then.
That is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
As the Senate impeachment trial continues, you'd be forgiven if you haven't been able to follow every single minute. So we're going to play a few extended clips now from what happened yesterday. House Manager Adam Schiff said Republicans would try to distract the American people from the issue at hand, whether President Trump abused his power by asking a foreign government to interfere in the election, and whether he obstructed Congress.
Every time you hear them attacking House managers, I want you to ask yourselves, away from what issue are they trying to distract me? What was the issue that came up just before this? What are they trying to deflect my attention from? Why don't they have a better argument to make on the merits? Finally, Mr. Sekulow asks, why are we here? Why are we here? Well, I'll tell you why we're here. Because the president used the power of his office to coerce an ally at war with an adversary at war with Russia, use the power of his office to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid that you appropriated and we appropriated to defend an ally and defend ourselves, because it's our national security as well. And why? To fight corruption? That's nonsense, and you know it. He withheld that money, and he withheld even meeting with him in the Oval Office, the president of Ukraine, because he wanted to coerce Ukraine into these sham investigations of his opponent that he was terrified would beat him in the next election.
Well, early this morning, after midnight, the Chief Justice John Roberts, who's been presiding over the trial, had to intervene for the first time as House Manager Jerry Nadler called on the Senate to subpoena former National Security Advisor John Bolton to testify. White House lawyer Pat Cipollone then called for Nadler to apologize to the American people.
It's about time we bring this power trip in for a landing. President Trump is a man of his word. He made promises to the American people, and he delivered over and over and over again. And they come here and say, with no evidence, spending the day complaining that they can't make their case, attacking a resolution that had 100% support in this body, and some of the people here supported it at the time. It's a farce, and it should end. Mr. Nadler, you owe an apology to the President of the United States and his family. You owe an apology to the Senate. But most of all, you owe an apology to the American people.
President Trump's other lawyer, Jay Sekulow, followed Cipollone, further criticizing House managers. Nadler then called Cipollone a liar.
The president's counsel has no standing to talk about lying. He told his body today, the president has told his body and told the American people repeatedly, for example, that the House of Representatives refused to allow the president due process. I told you, and it's available, public document, November 26th letter from me as chairman of the Judiciary Committee to the president, offering him due process, offering witnesses, offering cross-examination. A few days later, we received a letter from Mr. Cipollone on White House stationery that said, no, we have no interest in appearing. So on the one hand, they're lying because the House is condemned by the president for not giving him due process after they rejected the offer of due process. That letter rejecting it was December 1st. It is beyond belief that the president claims monarchical powers. I can do whatever I want under Article 2, says he, and then acts on that. Defies everything. Defies the law to withhold aid from Ukraine. Defies the law in a dozen different directions all the time. And lies about it all the time. And says to Mr. Cipollone here to lie about it.
Well, after that, Chief Justice John Roberts had this austere warning for both sides, citing the 1905 impeachment trial of a federal judge.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse. In the 1905 Swain trial, a senator objected when one of the managers used the word pettifogging, and the presiding officer said the word ought not to have been used. I don't think we need to aspire to that high a standard, but I do think those addressing the Senate should remember where they are.
Some of the moments from yesterday in the trial, in case you missed it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.